Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the all-new weekly media podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show today, Jeff Zucker, one of the most powerful media execs in America, shocks the CNN newsroom. ITV News Washington correspondent Robert Moore tells us why. The UK radio industry is still reshaping in the pandemic with big changes at Times and Radio 1. Adam Bowie is on hand to help. Plus all that and a little Joe Rogan chat too. Why puzzles matter to newspapers, and in the media quiz, we look at the other shows doing a BBC Three. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. So this week we've seen Spotify on the back foot as subscribers and musicians react to their hit show, The Joe Rogan Experience. Over in TV, we've had the relaunch of BBC Three, kicking off with a programme that was pre-recorded, presumably to avoid the fate of GB News' opening night. Over at Channel 4, they welcomed Andrew Neil for a special, with talks about a new series ongoing. Plus, Ofcom are investigating their subtitle snafu. In print, newspaper group Archant's back up for sale as its private equity owner R Capital look for a buyer after only 18 months in. And of course, all the news channels were excitedly broadcasting the arrival of a black and white PDF, the author being one Sue Gray. But let's cover some of the big stories of the media week, the things that we've all been talking about. Joining me today is Washington correspondent of ITV News, Robert Moore. You were on an RTS panel this week talking about your role in the Capitol riots, on the reporting side, I should add. A year on, is it something that still influences your reporting or how you feel about the city you're in?
Sure. I mean, look, January the 6th was a sort of big impact story for me, but also for ITV News and potentially for British television. You know, I've tried to use it and become an advocate for this sort of style of British television journalism that is at the heart of what we and Sky and the BBC and Channel 4 do, which is eyewitness journalism. And if you live here, Matt, you realize that, you know, there is another model for television news, which is studio and panel discussions. And I'm not an advocate for that. I think what we do in Britain, eyewitness reporting, getting reporters onto the front line, telling that story to our audience back home, that is exactly a superior form of television news. That's what I'm an advocate of. And if January the 6th can be leveraged to show that and to show its superiority over these endless discussion panels that are a feature of American cable TV news, and that's great. So I see January the 6th through that prism now, really, as a sort of advocacy for British journalism.
I mean, you obviously went into the Capitol, whereas actually other news operators didn't. And I read that you sort of assumed that they were going to be somewhere else.
That's true. Yes. So, we were kind of embedded ourselves with the mob, if you like. You know, we were surrounded by those Trump supporters. They stormed the Capitol. I stormed the Capitol with them. As some as some American wit said, I was the first a Brit to storm Congress since the War of 1812. So I take some credit for that. But, it is true that other people were stuck in studios or doing live reporting. Other people were in sort of rooms and they had to stay there because of the sort of threat. So, we did what we do for a living, which is, you know, report on the front line and bring that news as quickly and as accurately as possible to a British TV audience.
I mean, ITN's been having somewhat of a purple patch recently. Obviously, Partygate scoops, extension of ITV News, the 6:30 bulletin now going an hour. I mean, you're obviously in America, but what's the mood like at ITV Towers and with the teams?
Yeah, I think really strong. I think you're right to describe it as a purple patch. I mean, the sort of work that Paul Brand is doing on the Partygate story, but the whole political team at ITV News, Robert Peston, obviously. But there is a sort of spring in our step. January the 6th was part of that. But also Dan Hewitt's sort of, you know, technically rather unglamorous reporting on social housing conditions. You know, we own that because, you know, it's giving people a voice who otherwise aren't heard in the sort of, you know, echo chambers of social media and television news. So it's, we're just delighted that we're kind of on several fronts, politics, sort of social affairs with Dan Hewitt's reporting, overseas reporting with our stuff on January the 6th, but our other stuff in Ukraine and so on. We're proud that that's kind of having an impact and being recognized. I mean, we don't, you know, work for, you know, peer acclaim, let's say, put it that way, Matt, or for awards. But, you know, if there's recognition for the newsroom, for the sort of agenda that we have, then we'll take it with pleasure.
And joining me and Robert, we also welcome back to the show TV and audio critic Scott Bryan.
Hello.
Scott, you've been writing about the relaunch of BBC Three for the New York Times. Was it hard to make sense of that story for a US audience?
Oh, yes. I think because, for one thing, they don't really know what BBC Three is. I think also because they don't really know what iPlayer is. But the reason why I wrote the story and why they were interested in it in the first place was, I think, the fact that at a time when the assumption is that all audiences are heading just towards streaming, streaming's the end point, streaming's the future, this was a channel that had made that transition to an entirely stream-based future. And now they were going back the other way. And I think it looks at the fact that at a time when there is so much competition, I think people, A, really want curation, but also broadcasters still have a bit of an upper hand when it comes to having millions of people viewing at the same time, because they're able to have those live collective viewing experiences. And I think that's quite universal for the US and for the UK. And what was also fascinating is that when they announced that they were going to launch the channel, or at least in the run-up, they were pouring through different data. And Fiona Campbell, who is the controller of BBC Three, was talking to me about how they were looking at US trends. And at a time when streaming takes up about 25% of overall audience engagement, there is still a huge amount of audiences who still tap into a traditional cable-style setup. And I think a final thing to say in this is that I was chatting to a great academic on the subject, Patrick Barwise, and he was talking about how what we're seeing now is a transition from essentially analog, you know, people watching normal TV, to going to a hybrid model. There's the assumption that everyone's going towards, you know, just pure streaming, but actually we're watching a bit of broadcast, a bit of streaming, a bit of YouTube, kind of a collection of all three. We're not giving up one medium for another.
Well, someone and a company that's been very much at the forefront of multimedia and is about to launch a big new multimedia product is CNN. And the previous boss, well, the boss up till yesterday of CNN, Jeff Zucker, had a lot of power, but shocked colleagues by resigning on Wednesday after almost 10 years at the broadcaster. Robert, what's happened to Jeff?
Yeah, look, a real, I mean, not just a media story, but a sort of shocking media story, at least on this side of the Atlantic. You know, Jeff Zucker, understand, is not just a powerful media figure here, but he's also the really charismatic boss of CNN. You know, there are reporters and anchors here who would sort of put down their life for him. But he has now admitted to this unethical relationship with a fellow CNN executive, Alison Gollust. She was sort of head of marketing at CNN. And it's not just that sort of lack of transparency that has cost Jeff Zucker his job, but also what people are here calling the kind of blast radius of the whole range of CNN scandals. Because remember, Chris Cuomo, their influential, powerful 9 p.m. anchor and host, he had to resign, having been found that he was advising his brother, Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, who was having his own set of scandals. So when Warner Media lawyers looked at the Andrew Cuomo, Chris Cuomo axis, they then stumbled on the Jeff Zucker affair. So it is a pretty tawdry suggestion out here now that sort of Chris Cuomo is trying to bring the temple down with him, that he you know, even though he was close at one point to Jeff Zucker, that Chris Cuomo is so angry about his own dismissal that he had incriminating evidence against Jeff Zucker and decided to expose that relationship. In other words, you know, there is this sort of cycle of revenge and acrimony at the very heart of CNN. And as you have pointed out just now, I mean, this is an amazingly important moment for CNN. They're just sort of weeks away from launching CNN Plus, their kind of highly prized new streaming service. That's a very competitive marketplace. Now they enter that without any sort of leadership at the top of the company. So it's a big issue, this. And it means that sort of CNN's many sort of media critics here can circle with their sort of claws out and their teeth ready, because in this sort of toxic political landscape, CNN is a target, of course, to the Trump supporters and to others on the political right. And this has given the political right in America tons of ammunition to fire directly at the heart of CNN's ethics and credibility.
I mean, CNN employees and particularly CNN talent are big Jeff Zucker fans, aren't they? So they call it, internally, he's called Jay-Z, which I love. And they like him. And a lot of them have been hired by him. I mean, if you're talent in front of the camera, surely it's got to be a bit unsettling for you as well. And also coming up to a merger with Discovery. So that's on the horizon as well.
Exactly. So that's this kind of the sort of almost a perfect storm for CNN. They've got CNN Plus about to be launched. They've got a merger with Discovery. They've got talent that's now feeling disorientated and angry about how Jeff Zucker was pushed out. Jake Tapper was talking to at a sort of town hall meeting to try and calm the waters here, but in fact, apparently said that actually, you know, Jeff Zucker should never have been fired. So there is sort of disharmony amongst the sort of top line talent at CNN, and who knows where this fallout is, but it's given Fox News and the political right here just a ton of ammunition, and so it's a really it's a sort of rare and potentially pretty damaging set of circumstances for CNN to try and navigate all of their new projects and ventures.
I mean, Scott, we don't really have these sort of super executives in telly here in the UK as much as we do in the US. I don't know who the similar person would be here that could rock a scandal like this.
No, not really. I mean, this is the thing. I turned on to CNN yesterday, and it's so weird to see CNN reporting about itself in a kind of twist. But also the case that CNN has got a style of presentation where it likes to kind of cover politics in a way a bit like sports. You only had to watch the election with the sound effects that were coming in for every single part. And I was staying up until 5 a.m. trying to find out whether this small little district in one tiny state that actually in the grand scheme of things had no bearing on the overall presidential result were about to go and call in their results. It's Jeff's influence, I think, in terms of having this kind of suspension and live element on absolutely everything, making you feel that you have to be part of that moment. And of course, I guess detractors are saying that actually the discourse within the US has been worsened by the fact that, I mean, firstly, for giving Trump a platform, but also just in terms of having two different styles of presentation with people on either end yelling at each other. And I think that's kind of it feels for me, with him stepping down, but also CNN's new foray into CNN Plus, it sort of feels as if we're coming to an end of an era. CNN's ratings ever since Joe Biden became president has gone down significantly. There's been a transition away from cable. I mean, it still makes an awful lot of money for CNN, but I'm sort of thinking, well, where are we going to go next? It doesn't feel like CNN's going to be right at the emphasis of it for the time being.
Yeah, I think, Scott, you're absolutely right, Scott. I mean, that is actually the other element of the perfect storm we haven't even mentioned, which is the plummeting cable news ratings here. You know, Donald Trump's era in the White House was sort of gold dust for cable television news. Now he's gone. We've got the Biden administration, and the result has been an absolute sort of car crash for ratings here for cable television news. So that's the other element that Scott quite rightly mentions. But I mean, there's so many ironies in all of this. It's sort of Jeff Zucker, of course, and Donald Trump were close friends. You know, he brought Donald Trump into sort of primetime television at The Apprentice. Now they're sort of sworn enemies. Chris Cuomo and Jeff Zucker were good friends. Now they're sworn enemies, one bringing down the other, one sacking the other. So it really is a sort of it shows just how, in a way, how incestuous sort of cable television news is here. And there is an opportunity for a reset, but Matt, I wouldn't suggest that's going to happen, because they are really seem to be sort of doubling down on this sort of polarized, hyper-partisan sort of panel-driven network news. And that's what I'm a big opponent of. And that's why I think the British television model is so superior to having, you know, 10 people in a studio all shouting at each other, which produces a lot of noise, but remarkably little light.
All in separate boxes. Also, I think what's interesting is at least it provides good content for a new HBO Max series. So at least they've got that internally. That'd be good for
There's
that.
There's funny more material for The Morning Show season 3 when that turns around,
yes,
next year.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Another of Zucker's proteges was actually Joe Rogan. He hired him for the game show Fear Factor, which partly established Joe. But he's now been getting Spotify into trouble with accusations that his podcast includes misinformation around the pandemic, with musicians, podcasters and subscribers starting to boycott the app. Robert, even the White House got involved with some of Joe Rogan's misinformation, I think.
You're right, they did. I mean, this is because, you know, Joe Rogan is just sort of the most high-profile case of this. But what we've got in America, you know, in this sort of media landscape here, is a complete collision between sort of First Amendment purists who believe that anything should be said, that free speech is the most important tenet of American democracy, and those who say, no, hang on a second, you know, we are now in a world of sort of toxic misinformation, and we have to be careful, and we have to sort of police what's out there. At least, you know, to be cautious what's out there on social media and other sort of streaming platforms. And so Joe Rogan has sort of touched into this. So no wonder the White House is involved. I mean, if you remember, Neil Young withdrew his music because describing the Joe Rogan podcast as the home of life-threatening COVID misinformation. Joni Mitchell and others followed suit. There's now kind of lots of sort of attempts to sort of to boycott Spotify. But I think Spotify, you know, is saying, look, we'll try and correct misinformation where we can. Their CEO has described this as a sort of learning opportunity, and has suggested that, you know, Spotify will improve its sort of services, but doesn't need to change its fundamental model. So, yeah, Joe Rogan is just the sort of most popular podcast figure here by a country mile, but he's touching on something, a much more sort of bigger, broader sort of media issue of freedom of speech versus sort of hate speech, misinformation, for fake news and so on. So it touches on a really kind of controversial, toxic part of the media landscape here.
Well, Scott, I mean, this is a real problem for Spotify. I mean, it's not even a question of if they're a platform or a publisher, because, you know, they have a deal with Rogan. They pay him $100 million. Have they handled this well?
No. I mean, I think it's just been a big old mess from the start. But it's also one, to me, that has felt like it's been in the making for months. I mean, Joe Rogan's comments about the coronavirus and having guests who are deniers or might be sort of spreading misinformation has been going on for months. It literally took artists removing their music from the platform for really, I think, Spotify to take some action. And you know, there is this wider, never-ending debate about how much are providers responsible for the content that's on their platform. But the fact that 100 million had crossed hands within this, but also how people who are completely unconnected to it, ordinary members of the public trying to listen to their music, are now starting to think, well, where's some of my songs gone? I don't listen to Joe Rogan. Why am I being affected? You know, it has all of the basis for something that is going to be a real headache for Spotify. And as you know, Matt, they've been, you know, emphasizing a lot more that podcasting is the future for them. Audio is the future. They've been investing a lot in audio. And this is the first time that it's now come around to scare them, because now they're a bit like, oh, the thing that we're really thinking our future is now a possible liability.
There was some great reporting from The Verge today about some kind of internal staff meetings with the chief exec and other team members. And a lot of the podcast team are doing really great stuff around Black Lives Matter, around bringing in underrepresented groups to podcasting. And there was some reporting that actually, you know, how can they attract those sorts of people if they're alongside Joe Rogan, or if the platform takes a more sort of centrist view of saying, hey, actually, we're just here for everybody. You know, is that really sustainable, Robert? Can they get away with just saying, hey, we're just here for everyone?
It's very difficult for them. I mean, you know, what Spotify and Daniel Eck have said, who's the CEO, is that they're going to add advisories. You know, they're going to try and put things into context to try and help inform people who are listening to sort of controversial podcasts, a bit like other sort of, you know, Facebook and others are trying to do. But, you know, I don't know if Scott feels that that's adequate. I mean, is it, you know, is it adequate when lives are at risk and when the question is, you know, about vaccine skepticism, is adding advisories sufficient or should Spotify be tougher? It's an excellent question. And I don't think any sort of streaming service, any platform has adequately dealt yet with this issue. I mean, would you give high marks to anybody, Scott, for how they're handling this sort of moment?
Not really. I mean, you still see on Instagram some people who spread misinformation given verified status who are allowed to propel their info all the time. And of course, they might have a smaller audience than Joe Rogan, but those are people who will tell other people. And I think just sticking a sticker on it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be fine. I think on a completely unrelated matter, this is the first time that I can be smug as an Apple Music subscriber.
It had to happen eventually. Yes. Okay, on to radio, and the quarterly radio figures are out. What does it mean for the big networks and new upstarts like Times Radio and Greatest Hits? Well, strap in, because earlier I spoke to fellow Radar enthusiast Adam Bowie about all the latest ups and downs.
You can't fail to notice Radio 1. I think it was a bit disappointing for them, although we can talk about Greg James separately. I know you were highlighting certainly Capital's share issues, and that's maybe related, similar problems to Radio 1. It's interesting there. There's definitely been some changes, and this is probably pandemic, but you can never be entirely clear, but there's some changes in the way mornings, the peaks are happening from breakfast to mid-morning. The absolute peak is still at breakfast. It's still at 8 o'clock. That is the biggest single listening occasion of the day. But, you know, for some stations, Radio 2 notably, where Ken Bruce is bigger than Zoe, and actually this time, for the first time, somewhere like LBC, where James O'Brien has just crept past Nick Ferrari, we're seeing mornings being, and depending on how you define mornings, morning being as big and or even bigger than breakfast in some places. So there's some of the key things, and then there's lots of individual results from some of the stations looking at things like how Times has been doing and Boom Radio.
So if something like Boom, new station for over 65s or over 60s, they had their first book last quarter, up for reach a little bit, but big jump in hours. And I guess that's very important for them, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if you're not aware, reach gets you listeners. The amount of time they spend listening gets you money if you're a commercial station. So hours are important, or share, as it's sometimes talked about. And I think when you've got a first radar, it's always the case, everyone's waiting for the first radar for a new station. You get very excited about it. And I think they were very happy and very pleased with their first one last time. But then sometimes it can fall back. And, you know, put the champagne back on ice in the fridge. So to see some gain, continued gain, is great. And then to get those commercially valuable hours actually quite significantly up, 36% quarter on quarter, you know, they'll be absolutely over the moon, I'm sure, with those numbers.
Probably not so over the moon at Times Radio, who had probably a very solid start in the sort of low 600s, but they've fallen back a bit, haven't they, in their second book?
Yeah, they have. And I think they're just still over 500,000, which I think is probably a nice, you know, all these numbers are round and immaterial in the scheme of things, but everyone likes to be able to say measure 500,000s, those kind of things. But yeah, obviously they've been around for longer. They were that unfortunate case of launching just before the pandemic, so it took them quite a long time to get their first numbers, being around for a while. But it's interesting, given the importance of politics on that station, and that this has not been a politically inactive time, and one radar does not make a summer, to absolutely, you know, mix and match metaphors here. So I'd sit around and see how they do next time, because this quarter feels even more politically active than last quarter, and you would expect Times to benefit off the back of that.
And sort of upstairs from Times Radio is Virgin Radio, which has obviously Chris Evans on the breakfast show. You worked there in a sort of early incarnation of the station, and with Chris, I imagine, as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
They're kind of an interesting place, aren't they? Because they're doing all right. There's not a lot of coverage about them trying to compete with everyone else. They're just carrying on.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they've crept up a little bit. I think Evans himself is back over a million this quarter. You know, there's actually a whole raft of Virgin stations. They've got Anthems, they've got Groove, and they've got things like that. But they're sort of getting on by, ticking on by. But I think the question there is there a sustainable business model? They poached Graham Norton not that long ago, and his numbers are nowhere near what they used to be for Radio 2, and that's even though doing two shows compared to one.
The data said that he's got 500,000. Graham Norton's got him with has 500,000 listeners in this sort of second book for him.
That's right, yeah. And I don't know off the top of my head what you used to have it, but it was many millions over at Radio 2. And I think the challenge there is to get from their big superstars through to the rest of the station. And then there's the business model anyway that they're doing, which is, along with Times, is broadly speaking avoiding ads and doing.
Well, one thing I hear is that on Monday there will start to be some ad blocks in Chris Evans's breakfast show.
I'm not surprised. You do need to monetize it. They monetize all, you know, other stations, you know, I mean, Talk Sport, Talk Radio, they take ads. So I'm sure the upcoming Talk TV will take ads. Yeah, that's probably a sensible thing to do. I mean, you've got to amortize, and you've got to amortize his salary somehow, I would think.
And just kind of thinking kind of post-COVID and looking at the data, radio is now very much digital. When we look at the sort of share of listening, it's sort of 60% odd. Digital reach is about 80% compared to analog being about, I think, 60-65. In the DCMS Digital and Audio Review, the government said that the UK radio industry should be preparing the ground for a possible analogue switch off in 2030. Now, this is obviously brought up all the time. Now, that's a decent chunk away. But is the industry sort of on track for switching over to digital just naturally without having to turn off all the transmitters?
To an extent, there is. It is. I think, you know, look at stations choosing whether or not to stay on AM. The BBC shut down a number of local radio AM transmitters, and I think over time you're going to see more of that naturally taking place. I think it's interesting to see, this is not quite the same, but see what Bauer's been doing this week in terms of turning or beginning to force you down particular digital things for logged in listening and losing access to their stations on services like TuneIn. And as those digital platforms become more valuable, as well as the costs involved in being on multiple platforms, I think businesses are going to make those decisions for themselves. It will happen. You know, now there will always be someone who jumps in. You know, if someone lets go of a frequency, someone will have that frequency. And would, you know, no one's going to hand in probably their London FM frequency anytime soon, I don't think, because someone can probably make some money on a London FM frequency still. But a lot of it's going to happen much more easily than maybe we think.
That was Adam Bowie. And for the Radioheads out there, if you want to hear us do a proper warts and all dive into all the figures, including the problems at Radio 1, there's an extra 20 minutes exclusive to our patrons. Just head to patreon.com/mediapod, choose a level of support, and you'll get that deeper dive. That's patreon.com/mediapod. It's there waiting for you right now. And with that, we'll be back with more media news and, of course, our weekly quiz after this. This episode of the Media Podcast is proud to be supported by Riverside, the best podcast and video recording platform out there. And we say that with confidence, as we've been using Riverside to record the Media Podcast for over a year now. It's easy to send out links to guests, check their setup right, and get recording quickly. The audio quality is better than you get with Zoom, and it's all uploaded in real time. HD quality audio and video, if that's your thing. And if there's a dodgy internet connection, you don't have to worry, because there's a great backup feature you can rely on to get the best show possible. High quality, reliable audio and video recording, what's not to like? Riverside is used by brands from Microsoft to TED Talks, Marvel to the New York Times, but more importantly by this show. To give it a go, head to riverside.fm and use the code MEDIAPOD for $15 off any Riverside subscription. There's a link in the show notes, but all you need to know is riverside.fm with the code MEDIAPOD for $15 off.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns.
Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back. Robert and Scott are still with me, and it's time for some media news in brief. Wordle, the puzzle game that has set social media alight, has been bought by the New York Times. They're your paymasters as well, Scott. Why have the New York Times bought Wordle?
I think it's just because when it comes to games, they are able to knock it out of the park. They just announced that they hit the milestone early of having 10 million subscribers. But when they drilled down for numbers, there were about 200,000 people who were specifically only using the gaming part of the website. Spelling Bee, crosswords, a kind of a core part of their model, in the same way buying the Athletics are for sports. So I think by buying Wordle, which is controversial, particularly the fact that they said the word that it would be a free in then brackets initially, it's caused a bit of unsettling because people don't want to think of it being behind a paywall. I guess it depends on what the New York Times is going to use for it. Are they going to use it as a way of harvesting information by getting people's emails to keep it free? Is it going to be put behind the paywall? Is it going to be linked to the wider New York Times gaming offering? I think those are questions that I think they're still trying to work out themselves. But I think the fact that it's been growing substantially, the fact that you can only play once a day, means that the New York Times obviously thinks there's longevity in this.
I mean, it seemed to me, you know, they said the deal went for the kind of low millions. Well, to buy a thing which apparently has sort of 10 million page views a day, that seems an excellent deal on behalf of the New York Times. They announced that their subscriber numbers have passed 10 million, partly due to adding in the Athletics subscription numbers, which they acquired at the end of the last year, beginning of this year. And that's a publication that's traditionally been burning through cash, but now backed by the New York Times, maybe they can sort of express it into profitability, combine it with their other subscription offers into a kind of super bundle. I mean, the New York Times has made a lot of money from subscription. It's really turned the corner. There was worries that it would drop after Trump, but actually it's been increasing. There's gaming, there's cookery. Is subscription the future of news, Robert?
Well, I think you're exactly right to say, look, it kind of relates to our previous conversation about how sort of cable news networks are struggling with an audience. I mean, the interest in news has, you know, rapidly kind of diminished here since the end of the Trump years. And what the New York Times, I think, is doing highly successfully is reorientating itself towards games and, as you say, towards cooking shows and lifestyle products. I mean, they're trying to create an entire kind of experience for, you know, anybody who goes onto the New York Times website. And I think Wordle is a classic example of that. I mean, it's, you know, we don't associate the New York Times kind of with that idea. You know, we associate them with sort of in-depth journalism, but they're having to reinvent themselves in the post-Trump era, and Wordle and cookery is a classic example of that. And if people spend more of their day on the New York Times website, then they will be delighted. They will be able to monetize that. And there's no question they're going from strength to strength, arguably too strong and squeezing out too many small players who are trying to make a living in the same space as well.
Well, back to the UK. Deadline's reported that UK viewers spent triple the time watching the BBC compared to Netflix. I think this was in some Enders analysis. Scott, what do you make of the BBC's beatdown of Netflix?
I mean, it is really interesting. Enders are very trusted in terms of having deep kind of insightful analysis when it comes to the rise of the streaming giants. But also we've seen over the last few months, Barb, of course, who measure audiences, getting in on the game, trying to see how big our viewing patterns are in terms of watching streaming giants. For years, I think we've had this sense, it's been a real frustration of mine, about how streamers are kind of this big beast that are being, you know, watched by millions, but it's really hard to know how many of us are watching them. It feels a lot of PR. They pluck numbers to show how successful they are using metrics that aren't transparent, that make them look good. And of course, all companies do this, but Netflix and other streamers are especially guilty of it. And now I think we're seeing a bit more transparency, particularly that the BBC, who of course are in this incredibly difficult scenario of now having the license fee frozen under inflation for 2 years, are now having to have also arguments on top of that they should become a subscription service. And then you're seeing data that suggests that, yes, they are incredibly important parts of our live streaming giants, but they're not really going to completely upend the whole market. There was other analysis by Enders that suggested that many people still see public service broadcasters as being the primary form of watching TV, and Netflix and streaming is seeing as essentially as a accompaniment, a sort of an add-on rather than the replacement for those sort of channels. So it raises a lot of questions. I think the other main takeaway very quickly is I would be nervous if I was at Channel 4, because what it does show, this analysis, is that people are watching Channel 4 as much as they are watching Netflix. And of course, we're coming at a time when the government are going to be proposing the future for Channel 4. And the government's argument is, well, we want Channel 4 to be more to be on the same sort of competitiveness as streamers. And of course, if they're being seen to be beaten by Netflix and rivals, then of course that makes Channel 4's position of staying in public ownership weaker.
Robert, I mean, Scott's talking there about some of the changes, obviously, that have been proposed for the BBC. They're now going to be on the front foot, particularly 100 years of the BBC, good opportunity for them to demonstrate all their good. Did you manage to catch their new 2-minute promo video that's been scrolling around social media this week?
Yeah, for sure I did. Obviously, an impressive sort of counterblast from the BBC, reminding people that there is such a thing as, you know, what they would call here the kind of water cooler moment, sort of, you know, a sense of a shared narrative, that there is something, some institution that brings people together. And of course, the BBC, you know, is in a strong position to say, look, you know, in their range of shows, in their range of on-air talent, they are able to bring together a sort of a national conversation, something that is notably lacking here in the United States, where we've got two kind of political sides who are just kind of warring with each other. And we've ended up with this sort of very toxic, not just political landscape, but also sort of cultural landscape as well. So, yeah, I think the BBC's pitch is a strong one. And, you know, within that, ITV and others are going to say, look, we're part of the conversation. And it's important that, that you know, we have diversity in the media, and that the journalism of ITV News and Channel 4 News is important too, and Sky News. In other words, you know, there is a role for plurality as well as to accept the importance of a sort of a central broadcaster like the BBC. So look, let's you know, enjoy the BBC, but let's make sure that they have to work for their money and give them tremendous competition. If, for example, in the area I work in television news, let's make sure they have to, you know, they win their scoops and have to fight for their, because it's competition that's going to be the best for the British viewer, isn't it?
Well, talking about funding, just quickly, Google and Facebook could be forced to agree a price with newspapers for using their stories under new laws being potentially drawn up by the government. This was according to The Times. This is very similar to what's happened in Australia, where big digital companies had to do deals with the big Australian news providers. Do you think that's something that should come to the UK? Should Facebooks and the Googles of the world pay newspapers for their content? Or is it up to the newspapers whether they decide to let Google spider their stuff?
Well, look, I mean, we want sort of fairness. So if, you know, if our journalism is out there, you know, we'd like it, you know, people to acknowledge it comes from ITV News. What's unclear, I think, you know, genuinely unclear, is whether, you know, the funding model that sort of is based on the sort of Australian style media bargaining code is going to help video journalism, or is it just a payment plan for newspaper articles that are put out on the other publishers' platform. So I think a lot of this needs to be worked through. Smarter people than me are looking at the sort of funding models. But all I'll say is, you know, where we do journalism, you know, we want it widely distributed as possible. But on the other hand, you know, it makes, you know, gathering television news is expensive. You know, running foreign bureaus is expensive. Having a fully staffed newsroom with, you know, well-informed, experienced executives is expensive. So, you know, we need to make sure that there is an adequate funding model that brings, you know, the world to the British television viewers' front room.
Scott, you worked for BuzzFeed for a good number of years. I mean, they sort of fought their way up into the Google rankings or onto to people's apps and smartphones. Do you think the newspaper's just being particularly moany about this and are just using their mates at the government to give them a load of cash they don't deserve?
Well, I mean, the issue, I think, is that when Google and Facebook make a change, no matter how small, it can completely upend a company's fortunes. And with BuzzFeed, I think I can talk about this as next employee, but sure, why not? Is at the moment that they changed the algorithm from being primarily less news-led, there was a massive drop-off on traffic and long-term plans for a business that they were making at the time had to be rewritten in weeks because of a decision done by a company that they are involved in. And if you are involved in a company like many others, you're trying to have a mass audience, but also you're trying to work out how other companies are kind of working. And if they change very quickly, then that can really adversely affect you. And also, I think that when you looked at what happened in Australia, it ended up being a bit of a PR disaster for Facebook because it ended up with them pulling all news for a short time. But instead of like drawing attention to what the government were planning, I think it put the focus back on Facebook of how powerful they were, because loads of people were pointing out, hang on, how can the company that's having a spat with the government can suddenly stop me sharing news on Facebook to people who I care about or on issues that I care about? So I think that this has a... I think they'll be looking at what happened in Australia, possibly with a bit of fear, trying not to replicate that because it can end up becoming a big argument with no clear real endpoint.
And all of that, though, brings us to the tenuous world of the media quiz. This week, it's entitled The Launch Time News. In honour of the relaunch of BBC Three, we bring you three media properties that are either on-demand going linear or linear now going on-demand. Okay, so all you've got to do is name the media brand. Three rounds, buzz in with your name if you know the answer. So Scott, you will say...
Scott, I wish I had a buzzer. Oh, was this in the email?
No, that's fine. Scott, you'll say Scott. And Robert, you will say...
Robert.
Excellent. Let's play the launch time news. Right, which on-demand service is launching a magazine?
Oh, Scott.
Scott.
Netflix.
Yes. What are they launching?
They're launching a sort of a magazine aimed at kids, I think, which is trying to be focusing on that. And like they've been doing this before. It gives me a lot of memories, you know, to when Sky did it. Remember in like the noughties, they had a magazine that went out to every Sky subscriber in the country. But the best bit about it is that they wrote on the front cover that it is the most circulated magazine, the most popular magazine in the country, disregarding the fact that subscribers of Sky had no choice. They were getting it anyway. So so it makes me wonder about what Netflix have a plan for it. They already do have an existing magazine, but you have to opt in. It mainly goes to people who work in the industry. And I think for Netflix, it sort of works because they don't have to deal with journalists. They can kind of do it themselves, market it entirely how they want.
And kids is hugely important to streamers because it stops churn. So reinforcing that is good business. Right, number two. Which German news channel has
Robert.
Come off the air this
Robert,
week?
Robert. Yeah, I can have a go at that one. I mean, not only has Deutsche Welle been fired by out of Russia, but it was based on the fact that RT has fallen foul of German regulators and has been had its license revoked. So that's the story on the sort of Berlin-Moscow argument.
And I mean, RT's had a messy relationship with national regulators, hasn't it, over the last few years? I mean, does it have a strategy other than what's driven by the Kremlin?
No, I think it's by all accounts, it is, you know, it is a spokesperson essentially for the Kremlin, you know, Kremlin run. And I think it fell out with the Germans and the German regulator because he was running under a sort of a Serbian license. But politically, it was moving kind of to the right in Germany, and it had sort of vaccine skepticism as a kind of component of its coverage. So no wonder regulators were getting concerned if it's moving kind of politically to the far right and was promoting vaccine skepticism. So, yeah, it does seem like it was the Kremlin trying to cause trouble in sort of German opinion and German politics.
OK, one apiece. Let's go for question number three. Which lovable cartoon bunny may soon, through a convoluted series of mergers and acquisitions, end up playing Premier League football?
I think I know the story. I don't know the answer to the question.
Scott.
Is this about the whole BT Sport thing? About how BT Sport and Discovery might end up becoming partners? Which I can see from either side.
The lovable cartoon bunny is Bugs Bunny as a WarnerMedia property.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, I can see that now.
So what's happening in BT Sport and Discovery, just quickly?
So BT Sport have been a kind of major player in terms of football for the last few years, but it seems to be the case that BT now want to double down on improving internet speeds and doesn't really want to run a sports channel as much. They've been looking for a partnership or a buyer for a while. And Discovery, that already have the Olympics, of course, throughout Europe, already have Eurosport, are thinking, heck, we can actually have a lot more subscribers and maybe grow our base a bit. So I can see it certainly from Discovery's side, and for BT, getting rid of something they don't really want to be that invested in going forward.
Correct, and congratulations, Scott. That makes you the media quiz winner.
Yeah, I defer.
Your prize is in the post.
I defer to you, Scott. Yeah, you did well on that. On the first and third one, you helped me out.
Scott, your prize is in the post. But unfortunately, the post is so delayed now in the UK, you'll never receive it.
Oh, wow.
Right, that's our show for today. My thanks to Robert Moore and Scott Bryan. If you've enjoyed this episode, show us you mean it by doing any or all of these things. Why not tell your colleagues about the show on Twitter or LinkedIn? You can take out a Riverside FM trial using the code MEDIAPOD. And remember to become a patron of the show at patreon.com/MEDIAPOD. And of course, follow us to hear new episodes when they drop on your podcast app of choice weekly. You can do that via podfollow.com/themediapodcast. My name is Matt Deegan. You can find my weekly newsletter about the audio industry at mattdeegan.com. The producer was Matt Hill, with support from Phoebe Adler-Ryan. It was a Rethink Audio production. We will see you next week.